Welcome to Client Development Process. This is a podcast designed to work with the marketing departments as well as attorneys to kind of give an overview as to the CLE course that I've put together, which is a four-hour course, facilitation and extra coaching for attorneys, really trying to help them create and improve on the habits of rainmakers. And what I want to find out is really and have you be able to come to the conclusion of what do you hope to accomplish with your marketing and with your client development needs for your firm. Integrating marketing and your sales or your client development process so that you can facilitate a common practice or a common language so that you could brand your message for every attorney that's in the firm so you have an organizational sales process. You could replicate your best practice selling behavior and really trying to put together a common brand so that all the attorneys have a common line of questioning. They're able to position capabilities. It ties with all your marketing brochures, your website, everything, so that you have a common look and feel to your firm and people are speaking the same language and they're able to identify where they are in the process so that people throughout the firm can help their colleagues be able to go into the process, be able to follow up effectively and have a common understanding of what a client's needs are and where to follow up and where your capabilities map to what their goals are. So, talking about institutionalizing best practices. When you have a predictable sales process, you can see what your buyers need at each stage and make sure messaging, your website tools, collateral, sales steps are all aligned to facilitate the desired customer experience. When you have an auditable sales process, you can see how your buyers progress at each stage of their buying process and allow your sellers to go into each meeting prepared. When you have a predictable and auditable sales process, you can see what is working from both the buying and the selling perspective. That way you can emphasize the things that are working and stop doing things that aren't working. And I'm going to intermingle client development and sales here, however you want to wear the hat, but really client development and sales just intermingle together. So again, how are we going to integrate those things so that we can facilitate the best practices and be able to take what your top producers are in your firm and replicate those throughout the organization and provide them those skills? So what is a client development process messaging? Well, it enables your prospect to visualize how they're going to use your offering rather than it being a commodity. And it's going to help them achieve a goal, solve a problem, or satisfy a need. And it's improving their buying experience by putting your attorneys in alignment and putting your firm in alignment with what a prospective company or an opportunity is so that you are in lockstep with them throughout the entire process. It enables sellers to consistently position their offerings at each step in the sales process. So what we're going to talk about is targeting specific job titles. And then really before you go in, identifying what are the probable goals for a general counsel, a chief marketing officer, a CEO. If you go in there loaded with an idea of what the probable goals are, then at least it gives you a basis to be able to start a business conversation, not just a conversation that's based around your legal capabilities. And then what we're going to talk about is what are their goals, but how are our corresponding capabilities mapping to those goals? And then providing a value message to them or a cost-benefit analysis by asking the how questions and the what questions and getting into percentages and dollars and how much is it costing them today and how many people and percentages, etc. And then we're going to provide proof points throughout the entire process as well. How do customers buy? Well, based on the research of Neil Rackham, who developed spin selling, there's three phases of the buying process. There's phase one, which is really your solution or your client development. There's phase two, which is evaluation. And there's phase three, which is commitment. And really, when I do this course in front of a group, this is a slide that we spend a lot of time on because when you can figure out where your client is in the process or your prospective client is in the process, it helps you get in alignment with their buying behavior and your selling behavior to make sure that you are in alignment with them. And we talked about how the needs, the costs, the solution, and the risk are identified in each one of those phases. how the needs really start out high in the first phase, and then as you're going through the evaluation phase, how the needs go down and then how they come up, how the cost goes down, and then it comes back in phase three, or the commitment phase, to where it's then priced. And as a client goes through the entire process, how risk starts out really low, and how as the process develops, it gets elevated to when they get into commitment phase. And what I always use as an example is when you're buying a house, how when you start out looking at a house, you put together your requirements list. These are all the things that we're looking for, whether it's a good neighborhood, we're looking for close proximity to work, to interstates, to schools, whatever that requirements list is. And then as you go through the phase, if you're working with a realtor and they come back and say, okay, well now the cost, we have a budget set of $200,000 for this house or $500,000 for this house. If a realtor comes back in phase two, as you're evaluating and they say, you know, I found a house that really matches what it is that you're looking for really effectively, but the house is $20,000 higher than what your budget says it is. Are you going to look at that? Well, cost is at its lowest point right there, because if it really is matching well to what it is that you're looking for, chances are people are going to go a little bit higher. But when you get into phase three, you're going to notice that right the day that you're signing the papers to move into that house, risk comes about, as well as now the cost, whereas it started out as a number in the beginning, and it was low in the second phase or evaluation phase. Now cost is really relevant because you're signing your name on the bottom line and saying, this is what I'm signing up for as far as a mortgage. Just an example of how customers go through all three phases, and how in phase one, it's dealing with the credibility that the attorneys or the firm has as a seller trying to get into that opportunity. In phase two, what is your service credibility? When they're evaluating you, how are they evaluating you, and is your service credible to them? And then really, when they're getting into phase three and they're identifying the price that this is going to cost them, as well as the risk, what is your firm or what is your attorney credibility at that phase? Because now when they're talking about risk and they're talking about the price of what this is going to cost them, what is the credibility? Are they making the right moves? They start coming up with all of the reasons through risk that they may or may not want to do this. So walking them through that phase. Putting together a targeted conversation list, it's really the key to a service positioning that you're going to be looking to do as part of this process. And what we're hoping to do is put together predictable conversations for your attorneys that they'll need to have to get your firm's offerings sold, funded, and implemented. And just as an idea of a targeted conversation list, if you want to put together 3 to 4, it could be as many as 10 or 15 or 20 people that are key players within an organization. What you'll find is sometimes the smaller the opportunity, you may end up having the decision maker who is also what we call an advocate or a financial approver. As the opportunities grow bigger, a lot of times you end up dealing with more people who are involved in the process, including people who you would want to bring in that are actually going to implement, bringing you on or bringing your firm's capabilities on. So going through this, for instance, if you're dealing with a director of compliance, their goal may be to manage discovery for litigation and regulatory response. Their constraints may be that they don't have any master electronic control of case documents. You could be dealing with a general counsel, which could have a variety of goals, but they may want to be managing or reducing the cost of their litigation. And their constraints are increased costs associated with redundant work on regulatory inquiries and late response sanctions. You could be dealing with a chief information officer within an organization, and their goal is to ensure archived information and document accessibility. Their constraints are just information residents across disparate systems. How are they going to be able to go get information that they need in terms of reporting? You could be dealing with an associate general counsel, for instance, who... their goal is to meet regulatory responses. Their constraints could be poor attorney review performance results and missed regulatory deadlines. Now, you may end up having somebody who you've got this, your opportunity that's sold and funded, but now you may have an adversary in there that they don't want to have to deal with change. So they could either be that, or they could be the person who you bring on as somebody who's really going to champion your efforts and is going to help you implement this opportunity. And a lot of times what we find is that you could sell and you could have something funded, but the implementation is what really falls apart. So as we get through this, we're going to identify those key players, the targeted conversations to be able to help them go through that process and be able to alleviate any kind of risk that they may see with going with your firm. Is your solution credible? Are the attorneys credible? Is the firm credible? All those different things and tying those to how are we going to implement this with the staff that we have in place and all the processes that we have in place so that really this is a successful implementation and a successful project. How we're going to do this is by identifying those key players, putting together the targeted conversation, and then we're going to offer more questions than we are statements. And to give you an idea, questions invite participation. They also facilitate alignment. They allow you to first understand, then seek to be understood. And then they allow others to add value to the conversation. Statements, on the other hand, invite contradiction. They can cause your attorneys or your firm to be out of alignment with other organizations. They attempt to impose your opinion. And in the sales cycle, how much opinion does somebody have in the first phase or second phase of that until you become a trusted advocate for them? And it also makes conversations one-sided. And the best sales calls or the best client development calls that I've heard from rainmakers that I've polled and I've worked with continuously are the best sales calls really are conversations. They're not presentations at all. So what we're going to do is we create a vision of how the customer is going to use your service. We're not going to talk to them about you need our legal services or you need our labor and employment or our products liability team or anything like that, but rather how are they going to use your service so that it paints a picture of walking them through the entire process. So to give you an idea here, kind of a usage scenario would be a potential way posed as a question that a buyer could use a specific feature, a product, or a service that responds to a specific business event that they may be having. The business event is using the event that causes a targeted buyer to need a specific feature of your offering. And we're gonna flesh this out a little bit more because I know this is a bit clunky, but in terms of creating an event, the question that you're going to ask, who all is involved, and then really the vision or the action, the benefit statement that you're going to possess with them. So next would be the question. After you've asked a specific event, if asking the facilitates buying. So telling feels like you're selling as well. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask them the question. Who or what could the system that you're talking about or the offering that you're talking about will take action to respond to that specific event? And then how is that feature going to be used? State it in terms that the buyer can understand and that relate specifically to their job title. So to give you an idea here, we're going to talk about a feature. And we're going to talk about, we're going to be talking to an assistant general counsel of their litigation goals are the compliance and regulatory response deadlines. So when key electronic documents have been identified, would it save time if the attorney reviewing the files could have the queries run to identify documents covered by the request and only those files folded are passed on to the reviewer so that they can electronically designate the files as their responsiveness, privilege, confidentiality, etc., and then generate the production set. So what we're doing is we're trying to identify what is the specific business event. What's the question in terms of is there a time or is there a value tied to that? Who's going to be involved? And then the specific action painted in terms that they could see it. Now, taking a step back on this is trying to identify what are your features or what are your capabilities. Your capabilities are something that I would suggest, and this is one of the things that we spend time on in the course, really a laundry list. What are the capabilities? Well, it could be that we have a national footprint. It could be that we are a litigation boutique or we're a transactional boutique. It could be that we have people that are in healthcare, but we also have white collar, or we've got IP attorneys that also work specifically as in patents and nanotechnology and some of those type of things. So trying to figure out what specific capabilities that you have, listing out as a separate capability. So we have, for instance, discovery management as one of our offerings. And then you're going to back that up and you're going to say, okay, explain discovery management to me in terms that if I had no idea what that meant in your world. Well, then we're going to go back to the business event and paint the picture. So here's an example. When new documents requested are received, could you reduce your response time if your attorneys could run a query of the requested documents that distinguishes between a new and previously reviewed document? So only new documents need to be reviewed and avoid conflicting designations of produced documents. So that explains what discovery management is in that world, and it paints a picture of how are they going to use that capability. Now, going back from there, what we're wanting to identify is what are the questions that would get us to that point? So now we've identified what it is that our specific capability is, and we've identified how we can tie that to an event, a specific question, a business question, a player who's involved in the actions. Well, now we've painted that picture. We're going to go in and we're going to figure out what diagnostic questions could your attorneys ask to position those visions of usage for your offerings. Today, how did the targeted buyers respond to those same events without your offering, and how would they be negatively impacted? And we're going to ask a lot of these questions in terms of trying to get value or measurement from them, in terms of how many people is that taking? How much time is that taking? Who else is affected? What percentage of this? How much is that costing you in compliance fines? All those type of questions that really get to the business event, but also trying to help you understand how much is it costing them today? Is the pain of how much it's costing them today worth the change for them to make to be able to use your firm and your services? So now, what we've done is we're putting together really a process whereby now you've identified a goal, and we're dropping, understandably, we are dropping people into the middle of a sales call with this, and we're going to get more into business development. We spend a lot of time on that in the course, but really what we're doing is setting up a process by which they could ask questioning and the messaging that not only the marketing, but the attorneys are going to put together. So, and the way we're going to do that is we're going to start off with a high-level question. And then we're going to get into an interrogatory engine, which is a high-level question, which resembles, what steps are you currently taking to respond to regulatory deadlines? What are you hoping to accomplish? We're trying to get that 10,000-foot level so that we're facilitating a series of questions and getting them to open up to, well, you know what? When documents are requested, we're having issues around that. When we're getting a lot of requests, and we have a lot of issues around that. It could be a variety of things. We're having product liability issues right now where a product's out on the market for a couple of years and then we start getting some lawsuits resolved around that. So maybe there's some risk management issues. How do we identify some of those things? So asking that high-level question, and then we're going to drill down into whatever they say that those topics are. And then after they get done and we've gone through all of our questions on how much is it costing them and the people and percentages and really finding out how they're doing it today, we're going to confirm that back to them. And it's going to sound something like, so your current situation is you've got risk associated with your products that you're putting out to market. It's been out there. Typically what you find is after 2 or 3 years, it's costing you X amount of money in lawsuits. It's costing you X amount of money in compliance or fines. It's also costing you company morale, this, that, and the other thing. Is that correct? That's how they're currently doing it today. That's what all of their issues are today. And it could be over one topic. It could be over 20 topics. And it's going to be with each key player that you're meeting with. But you're going to summarize what their current situation is. And then we're going to go over and we're going to say, well, what solutions have you considered? What other firms have you considered? They may not tell you specifically what firms. This may be an issue for them that they haven't gotten to yet, but they'd like to be able to identify. But you want to find out, are there any other competitors in there, whether it's internally, externally, or is this anything that they've even gone down the path to try to solve? And then we're going to get into the event question player action of positioning those capabilities. So, again, going back to the documents one. When new documents are requested and received, could you reduce your response time if your attorneys could run a query of the requested documents that distinguishes between the previously reviewed and the need to be reviewed or conflicting designations of produced documents could be avoided? So if you wanted to paint a picture off the top of your head, as we talked about when product liability, would it save you time or would it reduce risk if your attorneys had the capability of running reports or being able to identify risk or pressure points within a new product development cycle with an outside source that would be able to look at the environment, be able to identify any kind of products that are built into that, any kind of IP issues, anything like that. Painting the picture here of how they would utilize your service. And if they agree to that, you're going to say, well, if you had those capabilities, how much of that time do you think that you'd be able to save? How much of that in fines do you believe that you would save? How much more do you think that you'd be in compliance? They may or may not know, but what you're trying to do is get some confirmation from them that, yes, that capability or your firm's capabilities would help them achieve their goal. And they are saying, yeah, if we had that capability, we'd be able to save a certain amount of time or a certain amount of money in doing that. After you get done going through this this series of questions, what we're going to do is we're going to put together what I call an advocate letter. And the advocate letter really has five different parts to it. It identifies what the person's goal is, what the current situation is, what the solution is, the value that they associated with it, and then what you're going to try to close on next is access to other key players. So this is the first call into it would be somebody who is at a high level, a decision maker level, or an advocate level that you're trying to find access, or you're trying to get access to other key players so that you can get a bigger picture of the organization. Why only get 10% of the business when there's 90 or 100% of the business that you could be getting if you're asking the right questions throughout the entire organization? Now, that letter is going to sound something like, thank you for your interest in XYZ Discovery. The purpose of this letter is to summarize my understanding of your discussion. You told me your primary goals are to improve your management of electronic evidence so that you're better prepared to manage the complex requirements of litigation and regulatory response. Today, your attorneys are encountering the following. Electronic documentary evidence is currently archived in multiple locations on several disparate information platforms, and the volume of this data continues to increase. When having to deal with outside counsel, there is often duplication of effort, poor conditioning, coordination, and increased costs. Your corporate IT group, which has historically maintained your evidence repository, is overwhelmed, adding to the risk of loss, delays, and sanctions. You mentioned that these conditions have already resulted in significant out-of-compliance sanctions and increased litigation costs that ultimately impact the profitability of ABC Securities Company. You said you were looking for a way to more efficiently respond to regulatory requests and deadlines. You felt that if it were possible to the overall impact would ultimately reduce the risk of sanctions and improve your control over complex litigation processes. You indicated that you're interested in further investigation of XYZ Discovery. Based on my experience, I suggest our next logical steps are: confirm we're in agreement with my summary of our discussion, arrange telephone or in-person interviews with your general counsel, director of compliance, and CIO, who you indicated would all be involved in any application, implementation, hosted or otherwise, and then summarize our findings to you and to your management group and determine if further evaluations are appropriate. I look forward to working with you and your organization. It's a simple letter, and what this letter does is a lot of things. You're able to send this now to your advocate to make sure that everybody's in alignment, what their goals match up, their current situation, they agree to the capabilities, and that you have a good picture of this. Now, the great thing about a letter like this, too, is you could use this internally if you decide that you want to bring other resources in, if you want to bring people in other areas of practice, or you want to put together proposals. What a great document now that you're able to follow up with and hand that off on to another person that they would bring into a call and say, this is a snapshot of this opportunity. They've agreed to all of this. Let's go in on the next call. But now you have a full understanding of this instead of spending the first 20 minutes of that call really going over the same thing that I just went over here. The other thing is this document helps your advocate within that opportunity to sell this internally. So now, to go get other access to key players, what a great document for them to be able to show to these other key players and say, you know what, I spoke with this attorney and this is what we talked about. You know what, I think this is, there may be some opportunities right here for us to be able to cut some of these out of compliance issues or to be able to do this, do that. Let's go ahead and get these meetings lined up. And I'll say one last thing about the advocate letter. The advocate letter in certain organizations, if it's not a huge organization, this a lot of times will get an organization to commit in terms of, yeah, we want to go ahead and move forward. For larger opportunities where there may be several key players involved, you're still going to want to get those meetings with the other key players because you want to build the deal where possible. But I've seen this advocate letter effectively close the deal if it is a smaller opportunity, and I do suggest for every attorney when they meet with a client or meet with a prospective client to follow up with this letter so that it facilitates that buying process. So putting together client development process messaging. Well, we've already talked about the vision of usage and really the interrogatory engine to frame a question at the high level to get into more of the interrogatory or the detailed how they're doing it today and confirm and then talk about what solutions they've considered. Go through the capabilities, and then again, confirm that those capabilities could map to what it is their goals have. But what we're going to do is also talk about prospect and customer correspondence, which that advocate letter is. We're going to use that for each key player. We're going to talk about how to do things on the phone, how to put together a good phone script. And I know attorneys are not very receptive to having scripts, but when you know what you're going to say on the phone, and you can tie that to specific job titles, goals, current situations, and really be able to start that conversation to get them to say, tell me more, that's where we're going to start with. How do you take that messaging to effectively create a brand within your organization and be able to have the same message all the way through your advertising and all the way through from the legal assistant who's answering the phone all the way through to the top rainmaker, the managing partner of the firm, the entire marketing staff so that everybody is on the same page, speaking the same language, really putting forth the firm brand and what it is that is unique about your firm and your firm's capabilities to the community. We're going to talk about the parts of a success story that make a good success story. Putting together white papers that avoid the marketing jargon and really touch to the issues. How you could have that messaging affected on your website. Putting together demand creation strategies, the customer usage training, and then ultimately your attorney's training on client development. And again, we're doing all this so that we can integrate the marketing efforts of the firm with the messaging that each attorney has when they go out into the market and really taking the best habits of your top performers and being able to replicate them throughout the organization. And as we touched on, helping targeted buyers progress through their buying cycle to a vision of how they could use your offerings, not selling, but how are they going to use your offerings to be able to achieve a goal, solve a problem, or satisfy a need. So let's talk about selling behaviors here for a second. Traditional and customer-focused selling behaviors. Traditional selling behaviors probably make up about 80% of an organization, and that's from sales organizations to operations, all law firms, you name it. You have your traditional type of sales type of organization, and let's face it, every organization is in sales at some level. Traditional people give opinions. They make presentations. They come in and they just dump a lot of features on somebody. They sell on bended knee, so they get out of alignment with organizations. They sell to the end users rather than to key decision makers in an organization. They use weak, ambiguous, insincere, manipulative type language. A lot of times they're trying to compete just to stay busy. They close based on their timeline. In other words, a salesperson's timeline. They create messages on the fly, and then they sell without any kind of specific process. So they don't know where they're not making, where they're not doing things well. And when they do come up with a sale, a lot of times it's just a series of random events tied together by hope and luck. Customer-focused behavior, on the other hand, makes up about 20%, or really the high end of the rainmakers that are out there. They have situational conversations. They ask relevant questions. They deal with the people that they're trying to sell to as equals, peer-to-peer. They speak with business people about business issues. They use clear, concise language. They know when to walk away from a deal. They close based on a mutual timeline. They deliver a targeted message that goes right to whatever the goals are that the clients have. And then they sell with a specific process. Because without a process, they don't do it on purpose. So let's talk about a salesperson stereotype. And I always love to talk about salespeople to organizations. And I always hear the same type of words. Usually it revolves around a used car type of mentality. But a lot of times, these type of personalities come in, especially when somebody's trying to close a big deal that may end up getting pushed into the following year, which would affect their bonus and some of those type of things. So people sometimes change their behaviors and act badly, but talking about stereotypes and then how to undo some of those stereotypes if people look within and say, yeah, you know what, maybe I have done this or maybe I have done that. And until proven wrong, buyers assume that the people selling to them, whether that's an attorney or any other vocation, they assume that those people are aggressive, insincere, pushy, manipulative, obnoxious, overly familiar. I've worked with organizations like you, like yours. They're prone to exaggerate. They're inclined to oversell. They're anxious to tell everything you ever wanted to know. They're poor listeners. They're likely to do what's best for them, not the buyer. And then really, they come across as not to be trusted. And the buying decisions that folks make, I mean, if you want to put yourself in the buyer's position, these are decisions that are made within typically in the first few minutes of a buying situation. And what this course tries to do is put people in the buyer's position. How would you want to be sold to? When you put yourself in the buyer's position, it helps you to get in alignment with the people that you're actually selling to. So reinforcing the stereotype. And I always love talking to the marketing folks of firms about the stereotype because a lot of times these words end up working themselves into white papers and into websites. And it's one of those things that just, it makes it really difficult to overcome. One of the things that I suggest is if any of these words are in any kind of website or white papers or any kind of documents that you're sending out is, would it make any difference if you actually pulled those words out? Would it make your documents less effective? And taking inappropriate ownership is key number one as to the kind of a faux pas, if you will. As attorneys, as a firm, are you solving your client's problems or are you enabling them to be able to achieve their goals, solve their problems? And that's a nuance, but it's one of those things that you're doing the legal work for them, but really, are you empowering them or are you doing the work? And utilizing words like might, perhaps, possibly, probably, maybe, well, just a little bit, or insincere words like, well, obviously, basically, just make this thing as basic as possible for me. I want the dumbed down version because I can't handle all of that information that you're throwing at me. Candidly, clearly, trust me. Whenever anybody says trust me, I don't know about you, but I always put my hand on my wallet. Never trust anybody that says trust me. Honestly, let me be honest with you. Well, for crying out loud, don't start now. If you've been lying all along, I've liked what you've said. Well, how's it going? No problem. Well, how much do you think somebody gets out of alignment if they go in and they're asking questions and in the first 2 minutes, somebody tells them what their current situation is and they say, no problem. This is an issue we've been grappling with for the last 5 years and somebody walks in and says, you know what, no problem. How much competency do you think that person has in front of a prospective customer? And again, like you, like yours, you know, I've worked with other organizations like you and like yours instead of treating them as specific. Ambiguous words like integrated, cutting edge, seamless, efficient, synergistic, user-friendly. Our firm is user-friendly, synergistic, and efficient. We run a seamless operation. Hype words like we're robust. We're a robust firm which has service feature-rich. We're elegant. And we do things automatically, state-of-the-art, and dynamic. Words that mean nothing. And then manipulative are words are like what you need is. I always invite people to tell the person that they love most in the world three times in a 30-second or a minute and a half span what they need is and try to figure out how long it takes before that person tells you what you need to do. Closing on things like Monday or Wednesday, the red one or the black one, will you be buying or leasing? If I could show you a way, what if there were a way? What do I have to do to earn your business? These are things that are manipulative. They're kind of the old school sales techniques of trying to box people in instead of really trying to stay in alignment with them throughout the entire process. Now, a success story. Success stories have six key components to them. They have a key player, a goal or a specific business issue, contributing reason, capability, the benefit statement, and the actual benefit. And to give you an example, a key player is a job title and industry. It could be anonymous. It could be an anonymous customer as well, because a lot of times if you're dealing with an organization, they're willing to give you a success story, but they don't want their name used. That could be a key player. A goal the customer had. Contributing reason is, you know, the contributing facts that prevented the achievement of the goal addressed by the offering. The capabilities that allowed the customer to negate or overcome whatever their issue was. The benefit statement, by stating you or your company provided the solution ownership remains with the buyer. And then giving measurement in terms of dollars, percentages, a certain number of the improvement that was realized. So to give you an example, the key player for this success story would be a general counsel. Their goal was to manage, and I'll kind of read this through here. We were dealing with the general counsel. Their goal was to manage or reduce the risk or reduce the cost of penalties and litigation. Their reasons that they were dealing with this was they had complexity and growth of evidence discovery and large-scale litigation that was overwhelming the corporate counsel. They had non-compliance with regulatory response deadlines, and they were incurring penalties. They had frequency of lawsuits increasing, risk from reuse of documents that should be produced in one case but withheld in another. He said he needed a discovery management platform in place that would ensure a repeatable process, allowing the attorneys to efficiently respond to electronic discovery, collaborate across geographic boundaries with multiple law firms and contract attorneys, transform the electronic documentation into common searchable formats. In essence, he wanted a better way to manage discovery from case initiation to conclusion. XYZ Discovery provided these capabilities. The number of lawsuits filed against his company were reduced from 46 to 18 in a 12-month period, while associated litigation costs were down by 60%. Now, if you're trying to do business development by phone or through any other way, email or seminars, all you're trying to do at the end of the day is try to set a hook in. Are they curious? You're trying to get them to tell me more. You have limited time to get the attention and create curiosity. So that has the case in terms of email, in terms of if there is phone time spent. They're not asking the prospect to learn about the company history or to learn about any kind of technology or about buying anything for an appointment. They're looking to focus somehow on how someone else has solved the problem. So that's what they're curious about. When you're talking to high-level people, tell me, somebody at my level, what their issues were, what their business issues were, and how you identified those and how you helped them achieve that goal, and then any kind of measurable event that was tied to that. Once interest is gained, then you have the option of booking an appointment or engaging further. But you're not trying to close in the beginning on a meeting. You're trying to walk them through at a high level. Do they have any kind of business issues that you could use now to build that conversation around when you have that meeting? So refining your phone prospecting approach. The phone, a lot of times people look at it as an obsolete prospecting tool. I would disagree. I think that the obsolescence is used at different times of the day. And when you're trying to set up different kinds of conversations and you're trying to close toys appointments and that type of thing, a lot of times by using the phone, you can get through to people at certain times of the day, early in the morning, 7:30 in the morning, doing things in the late afternoon after maybe an assistant has left, calling on Saturday morning, using the phone, even if you're leaving phone scripted that don't sound scripted, voicemails for them. A lot of folks will clear out their voicemail on a Friday afternoon, and you'll be the first one that they hear on a Monday morning. It's not the only way, but it is a way. It's a way to maybe complement other campaigns that they're doing as well. I do suggest that people set aside sacred time on their calendar to be able to do this. Whether that is after 5 on a Friday, if it's or first thing in the morning on a Monday, whether it's Saturday mornings from their own personal office where they're doing this for a half hour, but setting aside some sacred time to be able to do that. True prospecting is really causing people who weren't looking to change to begin to look to change, and it focuses then on warm calls. Prospecting should be done into existing customer accounts. I think I read somewhere that there's 85 to 90% of the time business is done with existing customers. Calling into those existing accounts, having warm calls with other people in an organization that you could use as referrals. Your prospecting script should lead with a critical issue, problem, and a point to a reason for which you have a usage scenario or a vision of how that person used your services. I would suggest calling a single job title or vertical on a given day. That way, if there's a specific goal or series of goals, you're comfortable talking to that job title or on specifically to those goals. Call it senior executive level. Make changes to the script and track the kind of success rate that's happening out of that. Avoid stereotypical phone behavior. Don't take rejection personally. You know, a lot of times based on the message, they can make 100 calls and 10 will end up saying, tell me more or even less. But don't take that personally. It's not the most effective way, but it is a way. And then always be prepared in case they say, I'm interested, tell me more. So again, with the telephone prospecting script, is you're talking to a general counsel. Their critical issue is increasing expenses associated with litigation expenses and regulatory penalties. The reasons are redundant work on regulatory inquiries, late response sanctions, and then we provide on-demand platform for managing discovery for litigation and regulatory response. The result was within this company, discovery has emerged into a repeatable business process with improved efficiency, better expense control, and reduced risk of inadvertent disclosure. Consequently, the number of lawsuits filed against this company were reduced from 46 to 18 in a 12-month period, while associated litigation costs were down by 60%. That's the success story. Now, something like, this is Andrew Wilcox with XYZ. You and I haven't spoken before, but we've been working in the financial services sector since 1999. One of the chief concerns we're hearing lately from other general counsels is their frustration with rising expenses due to increased litigation costs and penalties tied to regulatory expenses. We've been able to help our clients address this issue, and I'd like the opportunity to explain how. If they say yes, then deliver the success story. If they say no, offer up a menu of other goals potential goals that other general counsels may have had. Now, one of the things I'm going to touch on just real briefly, because it is one of those things that that is becoming more and more frequent, and we spend a lot of time on this in the course, is the process for handling unsolicited RFPs. What I'm going to suggest is that if an RFP response comes in, and we're going to get into system requirements and that type of thing more. But if you are not the firm or the organization that has written that RFP, somebody else has. So chances are you're not the winning vendor or the winning firm in there. Somebody else has been in there. And a lot of times you can tell in the RFP specific nuances that are painting a picture of another firm. And RFPs could be generated internally. They could be generated externally by somebody coming in and utilizing a process to go in and really paint the picture. But an organization says, well, that's great, but we need to put this out to RFP. You could help us write the RFP, but it is going to go out to RFP. So you could offer a response to an unsolicited RFP by saying, well, we'll offer that response if you give us interviews with three key players, 1 hour interviews. In exchange, we will respond to that. Now, some organizations say we need to respond just because we're doing X amount of work for them and they need to fill that the other columns out, if you will. That's fine. That is a business decision that has to be made. But in terms of this, if you get one just off the street, you know what? We're willing to respond to that if we can get 3 1-hour interviews with the key players and learn what the business needs are, what the business drivers are into this RFP. But when you do get that, you do have to respond because that's what you've committed to. If they come back and say no, then you're going to write a letter just saying, you know what, it's effectively not our policy to submit to unsolicited RFPs. We want to be able to learn more about your organization. And an unsolicited or an email response would sound something like this. Thank you for considering XYZ Discovery as a potential approach for your client. The purpose of this email is to inform you that at this time we're going to decline the opportunity to prepare the response you've requested. We've adopted a policy to not respond to unsolicited RFPs until we have the opportunity to speak with those individuals whose departments and operations will be affected by the services that are covered by the scope of the RFP. Our experience has shown that this complete thorough understanding of what needs to be accomplished and why results in a more satisfactory implementation of the project. The client and the consulting organization are the major beneficiaries of this policy and approach. We would be happy to reconsider responding if you would arrange for us to speak with the VP of Operations or VP of Marketing and the Director of IT. Following those meetings, we will then invest the time and resources that is going to be required to complete the RFP to your client and your satisfaction. In the meantime, I've enclosed some detailed information on our services. If you have any further questions, please don't hesitate. Again, on an RFP, if you're not in there trying to develop that business, chances are somebody else has, either internally or externally. So if you're going to respond to that, the major takeaway is that you're the one that either has to be the one that's creating it, or you have to at least be able to have the opportunity to go in there and interview and find out what their business needs are. And if you have your capabilities that are unique to your firm or to your organization, how can you change the rules, if you will, of that RFP and expand what their goals are, so that now you may be able to move into position to win that business? And again, going back to how customers buy, now there is what we call the dreaded list of requirements. And if you want to think again about the house, you're going to end up having the requirements that a firm puts together or an organization puts together. Those are either generated internally or externally. But for the sake of this argument, let's just say that they're generated externally. You're going to have what we call Vendor A. And Vendor A is the one that matches pretty much lockstep with what those requirements are. You're going to have also Vendor B, and you have Vendor C, and all the way down the line. But if you have RFPs, a lot of times they have to have Vendor B and Vendor C just to be able to say that this was a competitive situation and they got other responses, but Vendor A was the one that we're going with all along. A lot of times this varies by the buyer. Vendors whose offerings best matches requirements can change during a sales cycle. And that's when I talk about possibly being able to get in and expand what their goals are and find out, you know, they want this. Let's make ourselves equal with those capabilities that another firm may have positioned. But then let's also try to position maybe some other capabilities and some things that are unique to our firm or to our attorneys and be able to maybe expand that. But a lot of times the winning vendor is often known before others are even invited to bid. Again, a lot of times they're the ones who are writing the specs. They're the ones who are the winning vendors going into this. The other folks are what we just call column fodder. They're just there to take up space to say that this has been a competitive situation. And all of this, again, integrates your marketing efforts with your sales and your client development so that you have a best practice for your selling behavior, so that you're able to replicate your best producers within your firm. You have common messaging, and then effectively you have a sales process or a brand, a selling process, so that it loads the lips of the people throughout the organization so they're all able to speak or they're able to ask the same types of questions that really gets you to successful implementation. So what are the objectives of a sales or a client development process? Well, again, putting together common steps and milestones, creating a common skill set amongst the attorneys and everybody that has a voice that they're talking to potential clients in the community, a consistent way of positioning those offerings. I mean, how many times have you heard 10 different people in your firm say 10 different things about the firm? Having a common positioning of those offerings so that it is a brand. Ways to document the outcomes of the calls, and that goes back to the advocate letter that we talked about. Measurement throughout the sales cycle so that you're able to figure out, you know what, I'm starting a lot of prospects, I'm in front of a lot of people, but I'm getting hung up throughout the entire process. Where are my bottlenecks in my pipeline, if you will, so I can figure out, here's where I need to improve, here's where I'm strong, how can I help other people in the organization, but where are we so that we know, okay, you're in this part of the process, then you're in this part of the process, what's next, and everybody understands that. And then they're viewed as helpful by the sellers. So, client development process pipeline milestones. You're talking about engaging, investigating needs, presenting an offering, demonstrating, presenting the value that is based off of the numbers that they're giving you, not that you're giving them, proposing, negotiating, closing, the contract or the ultimate PO, and the win. The customer, the client development buying milestones here are you're looking to take them from not looking to curious or tell me more to where they're willing to share a goal or admit a problem. They're willing to converse about constraints and solutions. They can visualize situationally the use of your offering. They're willing to involve all of their key players as necessary, depending on the size of the organization, depending on the size of the opportunity. They have satisfactory proof of your offering, of your service. They understand the value of your offering because they've told you what the value is, or they understand that by doing it with you, that it will help them save or improve in some area. They understand the implementation and the responsibilities that they have so that when you're implementing this, that both sides are working together on it. They give you a verbal approval, and then they execute the agreement. And how we're going to do this, and this is backing into the advocate letter. The advocate letter, after you've had a chance to meet with all of the key players, what you're going to try to get them to agree to, and this is, again, on larger opportunities. This isn't for necessarily your smaller opportunities. And if you have an opportunity where they say they want to move forward, and it is a good opportunity, take the order. Go through the process, see if you can dig a little bit, but take the order. Again, this is for larger opportunities. What you want to be able to do is take those key players and get them to agree to a chain of events. And that chain of events could be 5 steps in the process. It could be 20 steps in the process. But you're talking about things like proving the capabilities to committee members, having them possibly talk to reference accounts or providing white papers or publications, that type of thing. Facilitating cost-benefit analysis may be one. Defining success metrics. How are both of you all going to measure the success of this implementation? Provide documents for legal review. Gain legal approval of the contracts. If there needs to be a corporate visit, either by somebody high within your firm or they need to visit you all, that could be a possible step in there. Conducting what I call a content review meeting. And that's after you've had all the meetings, you've gone through this entire process, and what you're going to try to do is, before they get into phase 3, a risk, you're going to just simply tell them, all I want to do is have a content review meeting so that we can go over all of the information, everything that we've talked about to this point, just to make sure that there aren't any changes, and so that when you get the final document, there's no surprises. And that's it. And if you have all of the key players involved in that meeting, and there aren't any changes and everything's been agreed to, then getting some level of agreement to them from them before you actually deliver the final proposal. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but a lot of times you can shorten that cycle up, and you can also, if there is enough value established, move that process up. If they see, you know what, we're out of compliance, we're having a lot of issues around here, the sooner you all can get started, the better. But if not, having a final proposal on there. Now, this chain of events is one of those things that's more visual, and this is one of the things that I get into a little bit more in the course. But sometimes people like to have an implementation schedule on there, a phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, just to show that the delivery of the proposal is not the final step in the process, but really it's just kind of the middle part of this. It makes the close, if you will, a non-event, and it really shows them that throughout this entire process, this is the key targets that we're looking to hit in terms of time and delivery. If you have a fixed price deliverable, this is a thing that at this point we're going to hit this delivery, this delivery, this delivery, in terms of, and that may be flexible, but at least having that on there. And then having a success metric or a meeting to follow up on those success metrics every 90 days. And I say this because you want the opportunity to get in there if there are hiccups in the implementation, to identify where those are early in the process so that there can be things done. The last thing you want to do is have a client for a year and they're unhappy. You'd rather identify that 90 days in and be able to tweak those numbers if they need to mutually, or say, yep, we're hitting all the goals we're wanting to, let's keep moving forward. Big takeaway out of that is, if it's successful and you all are doing well, what a great opportunity to get in and start asking for more referrals, or to be able to ask for referrals for internal work, but also, hey, you know what? What other organizations do you know of that deal with these issues, and can you make some introductions, or do you mind if I use your name and talk about some of the things that we're doing together? Now, all of the numbers that we got from them, the how they're doing it, what's costing them, the percentages, all those type of things, what we're ultimately going to do is we're going to put together a value calculation worksheet or a cost-benefit worksheet for this. And that's just going to list out who the key player is, what their goals are, how they say they're doing it today. It's costing them a certain amount today. The improvement that they said that they could get if they had your capability. So, you know what? We could reduce our fines by 50%. Well, that's them telling you that, not you telling them that. Well, you know, our fines are costing us $1 million a year. If we had this capability, I think we could actually, if we were proactive, I think we could eliminate that by 100%. Well, maybe they want to risk adjust that down to 50 or 75, whatever their number is. Okay, so it's $1 million fine that you're having every year. If you can reduce that by 50%, the value of that would be $500,000 in value. And we're going to take that across from the key player to their goal, to how they're doing it today, to the improvement that they said they could see, to what that ultimate value is. Now, the thing about engaging all of those key players is all of those key players are going to have a way that it's costing them today. They're hopefully going to see some value in there and some level of improvement. That improvement may end up being, and the value may end up being, intangible, which is fine. Ideally, you want to get to some metric, but if it isn't intangible and it just helps them get their job done better, you know what? A lot of times that moves the deal too. And you can add up all of those values, and you're going to put together a total potential net benefit value to them, and you're going to break that out. That number may be very large. It may end up breaking out to per year. I suggest that you break that out to per month, per week, and the reason being is if you're trying to get them at the content review meeting to move forward, and there is a compelling value or compelling business case that they've laid out for you, the cost of delay of a couple of weeks or a week of doing the delivery, well, why not go ahead and just get started now if that's possible? So, integrating marketing with your client development. We've touched on this several times throughout this entire podcast, but really the common objective is the entire customer experience that you're trying to put together. You're trying to facilitating the customer's buying process, helping them understand how they can achieve a goal, solve a problem, or satisfy a need through the use of the offering that you're putting forward. The sales owns the selling process, but the messaging supports the targeted conversations for each step of the sales process. And what we get into is, some organizations do this more effectively than others or more in depth. Really, we get into some of the pipelines, some of the management of this. Really, this comes down to an attorney utilizing this to be able to manage to the process themselves. But what we have is a slide that shows the entire process, and then we show where the pipeline or the milestones map up to each step of that process. So if they're in the first phase and they're an active candidate, or there's been a goal shared, if you have an advocate shared and you've been able to send a letter to them, what probability of winning that business can you associate to that? Are they in the evaluation phase? What probability can you associate with that? And then obviously when they give you a verbal, and then you've had a win-loss. But this way it helps figure out, okay, you know what? I've tried to close them too early. Maybe I need to take a step back and I need to identify their goals. I need to figure out what their current issues are before, and then document that. Maybe that's, you know, I've missed that step of the process. Well, being able to manage that process themselves, as well as from a marketing and from a sales mechanism of a firm, everybody could understand where they are and have that common messaging internally. And then being able to grade those opportunities, and we can go over more in detail how you grade those opportunities from an inactive to an active, if there's a goal shared, if an advocate's been identified, if they're in the evaluation phase, and really being able to put percentages alongside of that. So, now what? Now that we've talked about the different parts of the process really briefly, what will you do differently? And then what can you do as a firm or as an attorney to effectively be able to close more business? The first step is setting goals and making them actionable. And I like to use the acronym SMART, which is smart, measurable, actionable, relevant, and time-bound goals. Now, one of the things that we get into a lot more detail in the course. It is a four-hour, four CLE course. But there's also coaching, and I work with different firms to customize the presentation if it is a boutique or whatever areas of practice that they have. But really the best part of the course, it is the 4 hours, but it is the facilitation of the conversation back and forth between people in a firm where they're able to identify, yeah, you know what, maybe I could team up with you on this opportunity, or this opportunity sounds like this, or you know what, I haven't identified a goal. This is where I need to do this. There's a lot of aha moments that people get to have when they're all sitting around a table where they could put together deals that really makes it a powerful event. I also do coaching individually with associates that may be kind of close to making partnership. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, I want people who have books of business, but I've got these strong associates. How do I get them from being good attorneys to being good partners where they're able to make generate that book of business? At this point, they may have just been doing legal work, but they've never had to have a business conversation before. So working with them on individual coaching on how they would go about doing that. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to go through this podcast. If you'd like to reach out to me, I can be reached in many different ways. My phone number is 850-893-8984. You can view my website, which is wilcox-legal.com. My email is andrew@wilcox-legal.com. You can also visit my blog, which is lawfirmrainmaker.blogspot.com. That's without a www in front of it. But again, thank you for taking the time to listen to this, and I hope that I can help out in the future.